Welcome to the Pro Source Podcasters. I'm your co-host, Mr. Neil Wallace Bruce, but I am hosting solo today, as Justin Williams is out and about. I believe he's in the Atlantic attending the Junos, so good on him for engaging in some Canadian content. And today's show is also some Canadian content. It is a Summer Olympic year, and we have had some judo athletes in the past, but today we're going to talk coaching side of judo. So, without any further ado, it's Mr. Ken Fukushima. Ken, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. And thanks very much for having me on.
It's a pleasure to have you on. By the way, Ken, where can our listeners find you on social media before we jump into some chat?
They can find me on Instagram as Ken Fukushima 1. But they'll probably find mostly pictures of my dog and me, mostly my dog, and peaceful pictures of landscapes and things.
Indeed. So you strike me as someone who has a little bit of a creative side, well, maybe quite a bit of a creative side. You're artistic as well as being a coach, is that right?
Yeah, I'm an architect by profession. And an artist by, I guess, my other background. And judo is my hobby. It has been a very time-consuming and dedicated hobby, but I don't golf. So, yeah, that's kind of it. So I'm the judo guy who does artwork and architecture, and I walk my dog.
That's quite a combination, Ken. Yeah. Now, you say that judo is a hobby. Was that something that you took up as a kid? Was that something that you participated in, or was it something that you took up later on?
I started when I was 9 years old, which was not quite 100 years ago, but a long time ago. I started at the Japanese Canadian Cultural Center here in Toronto. Because my older brother was taking it, so I wanted to take it. And I did judo there right through high school. And then when I went off to university, I did a little bit, as much as I could while I was at university up in Ottawa. There's a very good club, wonderful family, the Takahashi family, and a wonderful club up there. And they took care of me while I was a student at Carleton. After that, I went to graduate art school in the States, came back to Toronto, was working for a couple of years, and back at judo a little bit, and then decided in my mid-20s that if I wanted to get judo beaten out of my system, I should go take a judo vacation. So I went to Japan for a year and a half, and met a lot of interesting people. It was really life-changing in many ways. And when I came back to Toronto, eventually when I went back to my club, my instructor asked me to take over the club. And sort of 30 years later, here I am, recently retired as the head instructor at the club.
There we go. Now, Japan has a special place in my heart. When I was in high school, that was actually the language that I learned other than English. Uh-huh. So I was fortunate enough to visit Japan a couple of times. So when you say that your trip had a life-changing experience, I identify with that, perhaps on a different level, because I certainly didn't take up judo, but It's a beautiful country. It's a unique culture, and it is, quite frankly, in my opinion, underrated, which may be a good thing.
It was really wonderful because I was able, because of my instructor in Toronto, I was able to enroll at the Kodokan Judo Institute in Tokyo, which is really like the birthplace of judo. And it's an international school. People come from all over the world to train and compete and just to visit. And I managed to get enrolled as the in a regular class there. I was already a black belt when I went there. I was in a regular class, competed in the monthly grading tournaments, and met wonderful friend and made friends with people from all around the world who were there at the time, and some lifelong friendships. And actually, it was through that experience in like the what 1986 or 87, because of that, I eventually met up with Shetty and Moheb El Nahas in Toronto through connections that I had made while I was in Tokyo.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was really, yeah, it was okay. So if I can digress for this like really weird karma judo story, when I was there at the Kodokan, I was staying in the dormitory, which was a little bit hardcore. Okay, it was like a barracks with a tatami mat on a metal bunk bed frame. Shared in a room, I think there are like 14 bunk beds in there. And while I was there, there were some people who had been there for a while from other countries, from Tunisia, from Switzerland, from Portugal, from Greece. Then the Syrian team came to train and they were staying there. So like I got to share the room with the Syrian team as well. Which was kind of good, except for at 6 o'clock in the morning when their coach came and woke everybody up, made them go out running, and then they would come back eventually after practice, and there's nowhere to hang up their stinky judo gis except in the dorm. So it was a little bit ripe. But well, but as well though, there was a more the VIP international competitors who would show up. And one of them was Muhammad Ali Rashwan from Egypt, who's a really famous judoka. If you look him up, or people look him up, he was a silver medalist at the 1984 Olympics, and he's really, really well regarded and highly respected in Japan because in the Olympic Games, he was doing very well, and in his final match, the gold medal match, was against the legendary Yamashita from Japan. Yamashita was undefeated as a competitor, but he missed out in the 1980 Olympics because of the boycott of the Western nations avoided boycotted the Moscow Games. So the 1984 Games in LA were his last chance at an Olympic medal, and Yamashita was certainly the favorite, but he got injured quite badly, kind of with an illegal move in the early rounds at the Olympics. So he's fighting on one leg, and he came up against Rashwan in the final, and Rashwan kind of went out of his way to fight awkwardly with his wrong side. In judo, you kind of fight right-sided or left-sided. It's a bit like, southpaw or like natural. And he attacked kind of awkwardly against Yamashita, who counterattacked him, held him down, and won. And after the Yamashita could hardly walk, right? And Rashwan had to help him up to the podium when when they were awarding the medals. And afterwards, they were asking Rashwan, he had his chance, right, for the gold medal. Why didn't he attack normally and attack Rashwan's injured leg? And Rashwan said very sincerely and very naturally, that wouldn't be the judo thing to do. It would be unsportsmanlike to do that. And that answer kind of says a lot about sports, the Olympic ideal. And just a lot about judo and about life. But in a way, for Rashwan, winning the silver medal was a better reward than the gold medal that day. So he was That was in 1984. 1986, he's at the Kodokan training, and I happened to be there then. And Rashwan is, okay, just so you get some context, he's like 2 meters tall and 160 kilos, I think. Like, he's huge. He's enormous. I'm 5'3" wearing shoes and 60 kilos wet. Okay. But Rashwan was looking for somebody to, you know, his coach came and told him he had to go running every morning. Rashwan figured out that I spoke English, so he sort of pointed at me to come running with him. So I did. I used to go running every morning with Rashwan, but it was really more like a fast walk, okay, around the block. This gigantic guy, mountain of a man, and me sort of like walking quickly around the block in Tokyo. And, you know, I kind of looked like his pet or something, I think. But we talked and chatted and became quite good friends. And he kept in touch with me for many years after that, which was very, very kind. I mean, he was this Olympic silver medalist. I was just this, you know, architect doing judo on a judo vacation in Tokyo. And about 10 years later, perhaps, I got a letter in Toronto from Rashwan telling me that his very close friend and his family were moving to Toronto, and he wanted me to treat his friend's kids as if they were my own. And they came to Toronto, they came to my judo club, and we became very close, family friends. And I looked after the boys at judo, and they were a little mischievous, but they were good. And several years later, Shetty and Mohab came because they were their cousins. And when they moved to Canada from Egypt, they came to Toronto. They came to join our judo club. So it was kind of a roundabout way that I owe any relationship I have with the Al Nahas brothers to the great Rashwan.
That is quite the connection. And and the common thread is, I guess, the, like you said, the ideals of judo, I guess the judo way, if you will, and it's linked all the way from the LA games, and it could potentially manifest itself in the Paris games this year.
Yeah, it's this whole kind of lineage, right? That and when I was talking with Rashwan's initial friend, who had moved here to Toronto, when Shetty was fighting at the last Olympics in Tokyo, I was in touch with you know, his uncle here in Toronto. And I said, I haven't forgotten that Shetty's there and we have a connection. I have a connection to Shetty because of Rashwan. And now he's at the Olympics and we're all really proud of him. And yeah, such a small world, but yeah, from LA to Tokyo to Alexandria, Egypt to Toronto to Tokyo, and then, you know, later this year to Paris, hopefully.
Now that's the world that I want to see, like everyone connected, everyone working together. This is beautiful.
But well, and there's also this thing about just, you know, in Japan, there's that thing, and you would know of having lived there, right, of on and giri, like you have an obligation to people, and it passes on, and particularly in the martial arts or in traditional things, it's, if your senpai asks you to do something, it's not, you know, it's not really an option, right, you just do it, and you pass it forward. And for the listeners who don't know about judo or some martial arts or some language things, just the word sensei means just somebody who's further along the path, right? And it doesn't mean that the sensei knows everything. It's just like in a lifelong pursuit of finding enlightenment, your sensei is someone who's already been where you are now, but it's just a little further along. And you have to help the people who are following you. And that's a lifelong thing, yeah. So,
yeah, and that is what life is should be about, like, not only improving or bettering ourselves, but also helping others along the way where we can.
Yeah, and that's really one of the foundational things of judo, as, I mean, the word, the do part of judo, or kendo, or aikido, yaido, that it's like Tao, right, in Chinese, it's the way. Michi, that the characters for road, or the way, the path to enlightenment is by doing something. And it's whatever the something is, whether it's a martial art, or it's the study of the art of tea, or brush painting, or meditation. It's with a goal of enlightenment and becoming a good person. Right? So, and that's where I get great joy, I think, out of seeing Mohab and Shetty. You know, I can give them a hard time when I see them and stuff, both jokingly and for real. But I mean, they're good people, and that's. I tell them always, it's the most important thing is, like, just be a good person, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, win or lose, be a good person. That's, and that harks back to that famous gold medal match in 1984.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly that, right? It's just, and I get really, I feel very happy. When I see Shetty, who gets more video time on Judo TV because he's fighting on the world tour, but when I see him win or lose in his matches, he's always got a bow and a handshake to his opponent, and he always stops to sign autographs for people who want autographs. And at the recent Pan Am games last autumn. He was fighting the hometown favorite from Chile in the gold medal match. And it was a hard match. And, of course, the whole crowd was rooting for Shetty's opponent. But, you know, afterwards, when the match was done, Shetty was the first one to hold up his opponent's hand and acknowledge his opponent to the home crowd. So I said, no, this is what it is, right? It's like... It's a competition, and you know, we're not we're lucky that what we're doing is just competing in a sport, right?
No doubt. Now, before Shetty and Mohab became the competitors that they were, they came through your gym. What were they like? How did you see them develop from when they first walked into where they are now?
Oh, it's funny, okay, because their three cousins who I had mentioned earlier are all a little older than them. The youngest of their cousins is the same age as Mohab, and Shetty's a couple years younger than that. So, of course, as often happens, right, the older ones kind of pick on the younger ones. And they kind of tease Shetty because he was the youngest, right? But they were both good. Mohab was already a black belt when he came. He was, I think, 14 or 15 when he came. And Shetty was probably 12 or 13, I guess, when they came here. And but they didn't... Did they speak English? Yeah, they spoke English, actually. They spoke French. I mean, their first languages were Arabic and French, and then English. But they're really super friendly guys. And Mohab is, and always since I've known him, been very, very talented, technically really, really strong, and very tactical. Shetty was very, he was a bit more awkward growing up because he was just like big, right? Like, I mean, you could tell when he was, when he came as, you know, as I said, like a 12 or 13, he had, you know, I don't think he'd mind me saying that he had big feet, right? So it's like, you know, he's going to be big, right? When he grows up. And he just had that fire, right? Like, he would just never give up. He would never quit. If it was practice and you're just, you know, like going lightly at practice, Shetty never went lightly. He was always really, really competitive. and it fired. It shows as he developed as an athlete more, as a at the provincial and national levels, you could just see that his he was so focused on, like, he just never quit. I mean, he just was so focused on, as a really, really strong competitor. And in his matches, he was able to just block stuff out and not overthink things and just win, you know. And Mohab could get very far as well and be quite successful, but he'd try things. Like he was always also wanting to learn stuff, and he'd try things, and he'd come to the club and say, "I saw this new move on YouTube. I want to use it in the tournament next week." I said, "Just what?" Yeah, I saw it on YouTube. Maybe you should practice it before you try it in competition. But he was just always wanting to learn more and more. Shetty just wanted to go out there and, like, do stuff. And it's very heartwarming now to see them discuss with each other, continue with helping each other. Shetty is always, when he gets asked after competitions, he's always acknowledging how Mohab was helping him and coaching him. And you didn't lose me, did you?
Nope.
Oh, sorry. No,
I'm
because
here.
my computer just doing something. No, sorry. So, but he always, Shetty always acknowledges Mohab, because between his matches, he'll talk with Mohab. Mohab can analyze things really well, right? And as a tactician, and explain to Shetty, some tactics to use for the next match, or what to take into it, you know, what his opponent's favorite things are, so he can kind of, like, process that. And Shetty acknowledged that, I believe, when you were speaking with him about how he's just become more mature as a competitor now, because he does think through things more tactically. And I think Mohab's helped him a lot with that. And maybe a little bit the other way. Shetty helps Mohab to not overthink stuff, you know, just go out there and, you can think up until the match starts, but once the match starts, you know, you just have to trust the process, listen to the coach on the sidelines, and execute. So it's very heartwarming to see them both continuing to try to get better, and to continue to get better and get good results as well.
Indeed. Now, by all accounts, the judo competition is quite grueling. It's multiple fights within a very short
Really,
span of
really
time.
hard. Really tough, yeah.
How does one get through that? I guess it's as much mental as it is physical, surely.
It really is, and I think that's one of the things that is very telling about really top-level judo competitors, is their ability to recover between matches. Because generally, as well, right? Of course, your subsequent matches are more difficult, because you're getting to the quarterfinals, the semifinals, you know, the final. And in some ways, it's a try to survive to the end of the day. But it's hard. And I remember reading about this too. Nicola Gill, who's the technical director, executive director for Judo Canada, and is, Canada's most decorated, famous competitor. I guess four-time Olympian, silver medalist at the Olympics, bronze medalist at the Olympics, and world championship medalist, and IJF Hall of Fame guy. But when he's competing, they're talking about his ability to recover between matches, you know, to stave off any kind of lactic acid buildup and stuff, but to recover for the next match was really, really strong. And that's what it is for these guys. And it's not just the day of the competition, it's the competition schedule that Shetty has to go through to qualify for the Olympics on the IJF World Tour is grueling. It's really a grueling process to qualify for Paris. They won't have the final qualifications done until, I think, June of this year, and the Olympics are in July, right? So Shetty right now is in Tbilisi, Georgia, for the Grand Slam this weekend. And then I guess the weekend after, it's in Antalya, Turkey. And then in April, he's got the Pan American Championships in Brazil. And in May, there's two Grand Slams plus the World Championships. And that after the World Championships is when they will, the IJF will release the qualified athletes for the Olympics. So really tough.
Yeah, not only are those layers involved, but if I'm not mistaken, weight has to be maintained this whole time, correct?
Weight has to be maintained. Any recovery from injuries is like, hey, good luck, right? You gotta kind of tough through it or hope you can make it through. And of course, it's just a lot of travel and recovery from traveling. But it's a really, really grueling pace. And for the Olympics in judo, there are a limited number of slots available. It's not just like, you know, the champion of every country gets to go to compete at the Olympics in judo. It's basically around the top, you know, around the top 16 athletes in each weight category, but only one per country. So, for example, Canada has two women under 57 kilos who are like number one and two in the world, but only one of them can go to the Olympics. In Shetty's category, under 100 kilos, there's Shetty plus another competitor, strong competitor, but only one of them can go to the Olympics. And then there's what's called continental quotas, so that the Olympic competition can have good geographical representation from all the regions of the world at the Olympic competition. So it's really the best of the best at the Olympics, and really tight, as you're acknowledging earlier too, that you've got all your matches in one day. So it's tough.
Absolutely. It's tough. It's cutthroat. So
cutthroat, and you only get one chance every 4 years, or in this case, three because of the off year. But I mean, it's, you know, you see so much emotion at the Olympic tournament of great champions, you know, in tears because they've lost, right? Or in tears because they've won. And it's just, you know, it's an amazing tournament. The World Championships, in a way, are I wouldn't say easier. They're different, right? Because every country pretty well can send one or two competitors per category to the World Championships, and they're every year. But the Olympics is hard. It's really hard.
No doubt about it. That being said, from I guess looking back on your time entering judo to now, would you say that Canadian judo is in good shape compared to back then? Has it come along as you would have expected, or has it exceeded your expectations even?
I think it's gotten a lot better. You know, it's exceeded things, and it's become kind of more professional. I mean, all the athletes on the national team pretty much are professional athletes in terms of that's all they do. I mean, they don't make a lot of money doing it, right? I mean, but they train. That's their full-time job, is training and competing. They have really good, at the National Training Center, you know, the best coaches, nutritionists, sports psychologists, physiotherapists, sports medicine people available to them, and facilities. So, I mean, it's, you know, kudos to them that they're able to do that and have produced, I think, more, you know, for relatively small country, we're doing pretty well on the international scene. I mean, as I said, we've got two women under 57 kilos who are in the rank 1-2 in the world, under 63 kilos. The Canadian athlete, Kat BP, she's from Montreal. Well, she trains in Montreal. She's Olympic bronze medalist. And on the male side, Antoine Valois-Fortier, who's currently the coach, just recently retired from competition after the Tokyo Olympics. But he's a two-time Olympic medalist and world medalist. And we've got now another strong competitor under 81 kilos on the men's side, who's ranked in the top eight in the world, I think. And it's hard to say exactly because the rankings change after every Grand Slam tournament on the World Tour. So, but anyways, those are and under 73 kilograms as well. To Arthur Margelidon, competed at the last Olympics. He's consistently ranked in the top eight in the world. So, yeah, strong teams, strong, and there's some young guys coming up, young athletes coming up as well. We're nipping at their heels, so it's good.
Great. No, it's good to hear that there's not only competitive forces for the current games, but also for the future. You love to hear that, and it sounds like things are where they need to be.
Yeah, and one would hope too that the current crop of Canadian judo athletes are inspiring young judoka to see, you know, that they, for a couple of things. First of all, they hear and they know that they're having success internationally, but also you can see it a lot more now too, right, through social media and through live feeds from the World Tour, and you can actually see these people and see them compete, and that's all good. It's not like just reading about it like 50 years ago when I was a kid, right? So
yeah, no, I get what you're saying there. I identify with that. Now, this has been a great chat, Ken. I hope that when June, July rolls around, we can toast the success of some of the Canadian judoka, and we'll definitely be watching with keen interest, especially, fingers crossed, touch wood, that Shetty and Mohava there. We'll have a keen interest of that, but also the other judoka that you mentioned. We're going to have to pay attention to them as well.
Yeah, the whole national team, I think it's a good chance for some good results if they have a good day. That's what it comes to, right? You got to have a good day that day, but you get up the next day. And that's why Shetty mentioned this in his review, right, his meeting with you about Kobe Bryant. And that's, you know, it's a good model to have, right? You just, you know, when you win, it's great, but you still got to get up the next day and continue. If you lose, it sucks, but you still got to get up the next day and continue. So it's just all on the path, so.
Yeah, no, that's great, and that's something we can all aspire to live by. Now,
best thing about judo, and this goes to kids or to adults or seniors or whoever's practicing judo, it's like fundamental to judo, unlike any other martial art. You learn to fall. The first thing you learn how to do is how to fall, because you learn how to get up, and that's what it's about. You get up.
On that note, I've been your host, Neolus Bruce. Special thanks to Ken Fukushima for his time, as well as Justin Williams and Colbert Aron. And this has been another edition of the Pro Sports Podcasters.